House Judiciary Committee. It's about 1:30 on, April 11th. Today we have Senate Bill 322 dealing with workers' compensation. The proposed method of going through this bill, we'll spend a week on the bill. There is a proposed agenda laid out at the door. As of all my experience with all other insurance bills in the last 4 years, this is not the highest degree of excitement with any bills that we've dealt with, although they usually have the most impact. Today we have to deal with the insurance issues, the insurance-specific topics on rate history, assigned risk, something from the Alaska Timber Trust experience, which I personally was interested in, and some industry aspects to it. And then the teleconference is a listen-only teleconference, although we will have it open for public testimony starting on Wednesday. Tomorrow we're going to listen to the Labor Management Task Force and the benefit structure from Jackie McClintock. And then Wednesday we'll get into some of the issues on the independent medical exam, vocational rehabilitation, and some of the legal aspects. Thursday we'll be dealing with rate reduction and hear from John Lewis on the Labor Management Task Force and some of the employer and employee testimony and public testimony at that time. And Friday, impact on workers dealing with total temporary and permanent partial disability and some public testimony. Saturday, I hope to wrap up the public testimony Saturday morning and then getting into marking up the bill on Saturday afternoon and see at that time whether we have anybody left interested in the issue or if we've all been burned out. So with that, the rate history, we have what Paul and Don, are you both going to do this together? What's your... Okay, why don't you join us? I'm just going to note that we're just taking testimony the next couple of days. Representative Barnes and myself are here. Representative Taylor is excused from the call of the House till Thursday. He's in Washington, D.C. Representative Cotton is stuck in Anchorage and will be joining us by teleconference here in about a half an hour. And the remainder of the members are in the hallway someplace. Thank you. We'll go ahead. Don, do you want to give your name?
My name is Don Koch. I'm a special deputy with the Division of Insurance. I have a number of notes, and this is kind of a rambling exercise, Mr. Chairman, but if you'll bear with me. The workers' comp, as you know, is a mandated coverage that all employers must have. It's sold through private insurers in the state of Alaska. Currently, as of January 1, 1988, this kind of insurance can only be sold by admitted insurers. Prior to that time, we did permit non-admitted insurers or surplus line carriers to write aviation comp only. That permission has since been removed. The rates and forms that are used in the state of Alaska are promulgated by the National Council on Compensation Insurance, and I understand you'll be hearing from them sometime later. The rates and forms, as they are promulgated by the National Council, then go to a classification and rating committee. This committee is a committee of the National Council, which we required be formed for the purpose of this kind of review in 1976. The idea being we wanted to have some kind of what I call Alaska Windy applied to any rate filings being made in Alaska and any form filings. And that has worked, I think, fairly well. It gives some local input into the actuarial ease, if you will. The National Council is a licensed rating organization under AS-2139. It is comprised of insurers. It is an insurer organization. The standards for the rates that the National Council files on behalf of its members and subscribers are found in 2139. 030, and those standards are that the rates shall not be excessive, they shall not be inadequate, and they shall not be unfairly discriminatory. Those are the standards that we look to when we have a rate filing before us from the National Council. And incidentally, those rate filings from the National Council are probably the most, among the most complex that we receive. The last filing, if you wanted to go by poundage, is probably as large as any filing we receive. The thing was about 4 inches thick, and it had all of the backup that we basically required before we would approve such a filing. When we do a review of a rate filing, we are aware of the fact that there are political implications to what we're about, and there are economic implications. But basically, we have to put those aside to look at the three standards that I mentioned a moment ago: not excessive, not inadequate, and not unfairly discriminatory. And we try, to the best we can, to apply those standards in isolation. The benefit structure is established by the legislature, and with a little help from the court system from time to time, they tend to expand on or expound on the benefit structure. So you have some impact coming from them as well. Further, you have some impact coming from decisions of the comptroller. The Division of Insurance tends to look at generic problems with workers' compensation rather than individual claimant problems. We tend to look or refer individual claimant problems to the comp board because, frankly, they're the ones that have jurisdiction. To the degree the comp board notes that there is a trend of a kind of action happening, inappropriate controversies or something like that, we have a constant dialogue going on with the Department of Labor Division of Workers' Comp. They will identify those for us so that we can take market conduct action and deal with that as a generic issue. Again, because the comp board does have jurisdiction over individual issues. The Division of Insurance's role then is to look at the generic problems, is to look at the propriety of the rates and forms that are filed, the rate structure, the rating rules, the policy forms, and we also attempt to assure that the database that is being used for these rate making is sound. To that end, we want to be sure that the payrolls that are out there, which is the basis for payroll, are properly reported. We want to make sure the insurers are doing the job in identifying what those payrolls are, or at least taking steps to try to identify them. We want to be sure that the classifications being used are the appropriate one for each insured. Again, if you don't do something like that, then you have a distortion in that database and the thing will mean nothing. That's not to say that currently there aren't some problems there. The CNR committee, which we do monitor, does deal with those kinds of issues. If there's a person who's aggrieved from the application of that rating system, the CNR committee is there to step in and to hear that appeal and make a decision on it. And frankly, we think over the years that they've been relatively fair. I have personally monitored those meetings since 1976. I guess I've missed about four, maybe five meetings in that period of time. And most often, I would say 95% of the time, I feel pretty good about the actions they take on individual cases. It's not to say that I couldn't come up with a different decision sometimes myself, but I think they have a reasonable basis for the things that they do. The Division of Insurance also acts as a information clearinghouse, if you will. People who have problems with how the comp system or how the rating system works come to us, and we regularly field questions of that kind. I get several of those a day, almost without fail. Basically, it's our effort to try to guide people as to how to work with the system, how to present their cases if it's one that's going to the CNR committee, how to present their cases to an insurer if they're looking for coverage. Since 1974, we have very closely monitored this line of insurance. Prior to that, there was little rate activity. In the early 70s, there were some rate changes brought about by law changes. But in 74, there were some rather sizable increases, which caused us to get in and take a much harder look. In 1974, there was an experience change of 20% and a legislative change due to change in benefits of some 11% for a total, this won't sound like it adds up, but it was a 34% rate increase in 74 In 1975, the legislature dramatically changed the benefit structure in the state, and in that year there was a 49.9% rate increase. In hearings the year after that, 76, we found that those, that 49%, 49.9, was insufficient. They hadn't really covered the rates immediately, and so there were further changes in late 76. To bring it a little bit more up to date, over the last 5 years, I just before I came here, I copied down what the rate change history was for the last 5 years. As of 1/1/83, there was a 4.6% decrease due to experience. 1/1/84, there was an 8% decrease in combination, which was a 3% law decrease and a 10.8% experience decrease. In 7/1/84, there was a law amendment change in which all rates on policies went up 5% due to a Supreme Court decision. I believe that was the one for Brown versus Alpac, which dealt with exportation of benefits, a subject which is one of the features dealt with in this legislation. 1/1/85, there was 0.1% rate increase due to experience. On 5/1/85, there was another law amendment, and that one was due to two cases, and I can't remember. One was against Paul Wash. I can't remember what the cites on them, but there were two law changes. The result was a 7.3% rate increase due to two Supreme Court decisions. 3/1/86, there was a 0% experience change. 1/1/87, which you've probably heard about, there was a 14.3% due to experience, and then this year, 1/1/88, there was a 25.1% rate increase. During the past 5 years, then, just to recap that, due to experience, you have a cumulative change of 28.5%, and due to law change, you have a cumulative change of 16.2%. To carry that perhaps to the ridiculous or extreme, since statehood, 1959, experience has changed, or rate changes due to experience amount to 80.1% on a cumulative basis. Rate changes due to law changes, either from the court or from the legislature, amount to 137.1% over that period since statehood. We've made no attempt to match that to consumer price indexes or anything like that. I just leave those numbers out there for what they're worth. One of the things that we attempt to do when we are looking at a rate file is sometime around this time of the year, we try to get some feel for what to expect in the coming year in terms of a rate increase. So we do our own little manipulations of numbers to get some flavor for what we expect in the coming year. The data that I have right now is really very raw, and I haven't had a chance to really manipulate it the way that I typically do. But if I had to guess at this point, I would say that what we're looking at for 1/1/89 is very close to a no change. The experience peak appears to have been hit, and I would look for no change, or at worst, a couple of percentage points upwards. But it's going to be very minimal. We're certainly not looking at any further double-digit increases in rates. That's based on what we have now before us, without looking at the legislation that you have before you. I'm not sure what else I can add to that, except to say I'd be happy to answer questions. I would make one further comment. There are a couple of issues that we have some concerns with in the legislation itself. I don't know if this is, would you like us to address those, or would you prefer to?
Yeah, why don't you highlight them? Okay.
One point, of course, is the mandatory rollback of rates. We believe it's entirely appropriate for a legislature to say this is what the level of benefits ought to be and put that in statute. But in light of the fact that we have a rate standard which says that the rate shall not be inadequate and shall not be excessive, we're not so sure that it's appropriate for the legislature to also say, in terms of what the numbers are, what kind of a rollback there should be. In other words, if you have a standard that says rate shall not be inadequate or shall not be excessive, shall not be discriminatory. We should also then be defining what that means in terms of specific numbers. And we're also the ones that set what the benefit level is. That's a problem that we have. Our concern is the effect that that may have on the markets. You know, that's an old, almost cliche in nature, I guess. We think it's a bad message to send. The Division of Insurance is going to be very active in seeing that whatever rate is appropriate, whatever modification is appropriate for the legislation that you do pass, we'll get what it should be. At this point, we have a letter from the National Council that tells us they priced this legislation, I believe it's at 5.7% downwards. And I believe there are others that will speak to that issue. That's one point. Another point is there is a provision in the bill that says that any risk that generates $2,000 or more should be premium financed by the insurer. The difficulty with that one is there are a lot of seasonal businesses in the state of Alaska. And the scenario you're apt to see is an insured will come to an insurer in May, just when the season's about to start, or April, and write a policy for a year with an estimated annual premium for the year, and that has to be on two semi-annual installments, half down and half 6 months later. 6 months later, he has completed his work if he's seasonal. And all the premium, the insurer will have half the premium that they need for the exposure they've actually had. What we would suggest is that there'll be some allowance in that provision for a business that is identified as being seasonal. If the insurer has evidence that that business is going to generate all of its premium in that six-month period, then they shouldn't be required to offer a semi-annual installment arrangement, or at least one, not one that's going to require the same amount of premium in those two installments. That's a concern that we would have with that. Those are the two major ones. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to respond.
Representative Barr, then Grunberg.
Yeah, you might have already answered my question. I'm just concerned about whether or not the current rate-setting structure is adequate to address the reduction in the premium cost. I mean, do you feel that it's adequate already? We don't need to mandate the rate reduction.
Yes, sir, I do. When the insurers through the National Council establish the rate level that they established as of January 1, that becomes their baseline. Any change you then make in the law will be considered in light of that as a baseline. So if the insurers say that this legislation should generate a 5.7% decrease, then that is going to come off of whatever the current baseline is. In other words, they don't take another look at their experience now and see, well, gee, we should have really had more than what they had as of January 1. They have to operate from January 1 as the base. So if you pass this legislation and it becomes effective on July 1, then whatever they're now telling us is the appropriate amount of reduction for this as a law change is what they have to apply to that January 1 base. I think that gets to it.
President Grunberg?
What do you...
Teleconference, please.
What do you feel about, with respect to the temporary rate reduction, which now appears in Section 44 on page 33 of the House Labor and Commerce Committee substitute, a provision that would state that any policy issuer that wishes to take advantage of the changes in this bill must voluntarily provide in its policy for this rate reduction, leaving it up to the carrier, in other words. If they wish to take advantage of the bill, they must provide a 6% rate reduction.
If they wish to take advantage of the bill?
If they wish to take advantage of the changes in the law.
Once, as I understand it, once you change the law, every insurer is going to be bound by whatever that change is. It's not an option.
Well, it depends on how you write the law. We could put a provision like that. It's an unusual thing, but we say you are not obligated to take advantage of the law. this provision. If you do, then you are mandated to do that.
I guess my first reaction to that was I would encourage you not to approach it in that light. It would just make a nightmare of trying a great administration. I mean, from a very selfish and personal standpoint, that would complicate my life quite a bit. If you had such a provision, you could likewise do what you're talking about. I wouldn't be real happy about it.
Thank you.
Don, in terms of rating Alaska, is Alaska rated separately from the rest of the country?
Yes, sir, it is. The rates that are generated for the overall base of premium needed for Alaska, and the experience that comes from that, is Alaska. The only time you get into a situation where you are, quote, borrowing national experience is when you look to the relativity from one classification to another. For example, suppose you have a kind of employment in the state of Alaska that is one of a kind. I mean, there's just nobody else doing it. They're very, very small and no credibility at all to that class. What happens then is you look at how that class relates to other classes nationally, and you allow that class to be, the relativity for that class as to Alaskan classes, to be swayed by that national experience. And not totally, you only borrow 50% of that movement from a national experience base. But as to what the indication is, the overall indication, in this case for 1188 to 25.1, that is purely Alaskan experience. It does not borrow anything from national. So our whatever is driving our rates in Alaska as an overall premium kind of thing, is based purely on Alaska.
What is driving the rates in Alaska?
losses are it. Now, whether there are more of them or whether they're more severe, I'm not really prepared to say what's causing these things, because I think there's a whole bunch of things that contribute. We have the highest benefit, weekly benefit structure in the country. We have an economy right now that is basically on the ropes. Comp systems generally have more losses in a bad economy or in a down economy than they have in a good economy. And there's a psychology to that. There's if there's work out there to be done and you're in a boom situation, there's good employment, people want to be part of that, and they don't want to be sitting at home. I mean, maybe they feel they can make some money in the workforce. When there is some question as to whether an injured person is going to have a job to return to, the psychology, as I am told, of that is that they're a little reluctant. I mean, they hurt longer. In a good economy, people who are hurting go back to work perhaps sometimes before they should, and a lot of times they're okay. But it's an attitude thing. We detect, that, at least from the people we talk to, that there's an entitlement attitude, and that affects how people look on the benefit structure. Just the whole world of things. There is medical inflation, and I don't know if it's even possible to control that. And I can't tell you which of these factors is the thing that's really pushing the whole works. I think in combination of all, each piece contributes.
Some of the numbers that we've been given here show that the medical cost is a large contributor to the increased cost, but also major permanent partial.
Yes.
Is a major contributor to the increase. Do you have any evidence to show that major permanent partial disabilities are any way related to safety in the workplace?
No, sir, and generally we haven't gathered that kind of data, and the reason for it is that what we look to as a division of insurance is the rate that is being established for a particular line of insurance appropriate in terms of the three standards I mentioned earlier. We rarely get into the underlying causation of what's driving that rate to be where it is. We really don't have the tools for that. I think the the ones that have the tools to what you're speaking to would tend to be in the Department of Labor, through OSHA, through the activities that agency engages in.
Yeah, does your division feed them any information when you see any trends coming of, say, major permanent parcels, to tell them, say, it kind of looks like this is getting out of line, that maybe you guys ought to go look for some, is there something happening out in the industry or across the board? Is there any relationship between that? Between
no, sir, it really hasn't occurred to us. Perfectly honest about it. No, we haven't.
So your division just deals with costs or costs or costs. They just give you the bills and you make sure that.
That has been the posture we've taken. I have to say that's changing somewhat, because as we see there are needs for information in other agencies, if we've got it, we'll give it to whoever wants it. And more and more we're getting into a posture where we'll voluntarily supply it. We've in the past year probably talked more with the Department of Labor, Division of Workers' Comp than we've ever talked in the past. And we're trying to search out ways where we can make the system work better. Admittedly, we haven't done that in the past. It has started. I think this bill has been in part a cause. I think the fact that we had the large rate increase that we had last January, January 77, that started the ball rolling.
Okay, any other questions, Don? I assume you'll be available through the week, or I have some other issues, but I want to make sure we get through all our people.
I will be out of town on Thursday and Friday, but I will, if you want me to come over on any of the other days, I'll be happy to come over.
Okay, thank you. We have an issue of the assigned risk pool. Is this on teleconference, or Stan Sparks? Do we have a Stan Sparks on this unit someplace? What about Donna?
She's in Ketchikan.
Paul, do you have anything else you want to add?
Yes, I did. I had a couple points.
Okay, why don't you join us now, please?
Does this have to be down there?
Just put the lock button on there. Identify yourself.
I'd like to begin with, if I may, with the question that was. My name's Paul Roller, I'm Director of Insurance. The question that you just finished with, which is, what is driving this system? I spent countless hours with the Governor's Oversight Group on workers' compensation, and in particular with this bill. And I spent many, many hours trying to determine what it is that's behind the increase in cost. And my personal opinion on the matter, and I don't have any statistics to back it up, is that it's really a matter of attitude and behavior that's taking place. And I know that's probably a very soft explanation of a very hard problem, which is a lot of money being paid for workers' compensation premiums. And I don't want to throw stones at anybody in this room here today, but I do think the issue needs to be addressed is that one of the difficulties with the workers' comp system is that there just aren't the kinds of checks and balances that you find in other systems to bring down costs. A lot is said that injured workers are malingering out there, that they don't want to go back to work, that there's no work to go back to. But I think it's also should be borne in mind that there are many people who aren't injured workers that benefit handsomely from this system. The health care providers, the attorneys who do the defense work for the insurance companies, the claimants' lawyers. And these are the people who I call the vicarious beneficiaries of the system. The system is designed that the more you do, the more you get paid. I would doubt that very few people in this room couldn't think of a very sound explanation why they should continue treatment if there was any medical reason whatsoever to do so. And it would probably be sound medical practice. But it would drive up the cost of the medical cost in the system. So I think Don is correct that there's a multiplicity of reasons of what's driving these rates, but I think it's the underlying behavior of the system. And that really becomes in, with the issue of these people I call vicarious beneficiaries, professional ethics problem, as to when the attorney who's defending the insurance company says to himself or his or her brethren, say, enough is enough. And the same may even be true to a limited extent with the claimant's lawyers. So I think there has to be some self-restraint on those people who represent injured workers to do what is necessary and competent, but not to bleed the system. And I think the system is bleeding. It's hemorrhaging. The other point that I'd like to make, and Chancy Croft often makes this point, and I believe it's a fair one, is that there was a historical compromise with workers' comp. The injured worker gave up his or her right to the common law tort system. And in return, society promised to pay that worker if he or she were injured. And there's probably no other type of insurance that we know that embodies as much social policy as workers' comp. And I'd be very, very careful to change that historical compromise. According to Mr. Croft, and he'd probably be better able to speak for himself than I could, is very concerned with that, and I think that's something that everybody should be concerned with here. It also goes to the issue of fundamental fairness, which is, are the benefits in the bill fair to the injured workers? And that's really the exclusive jurisdiction of this body here. But I think it's something that has to be addressed. Overall, when I've looked at the bill, and this again is a personal note, I felt that overall the bill was a good bill, substantively. That's not my position to say that. That's for you people to determine. But there are one or two issues in the bill I think that needs addressing. One is that there's and this is a comment that was received from members of the governor's oversight group, that there's a two-year limitation on temporary total disability. And that's very unfair to people who are catastrophically injured, especially a person with a head injury. Those are the people that can't take care of themselves. This is why the system was developed, to take care of those very people. There has to be some provision in this bill. The medical people harped on this, and I think they're right. I think they're absolutely right. There has to be some kind of relief system, some kind of exception for those who are catastrophically injured. Don has spoken about mandatory rate decreases. There's not much more than I can say in that area. We're opposed to it. They've tried it in Maine. They've tried it in Florida. It doesn't work. There's some the temporary short gain. The overall effect is that you end up in a worse situation. And for that reason, because it just simply doesn't work, that we are opposed to that kind of mandatory rate decrease. And I think under the present circumstances, giving the kind of voluntary or rate decrease that the industry has indicated they will give to this bill and the division will make every effort to make sure that that rate decrease is implemented. I think there's no reason whatsoever to mandate rate decreases. There's two other points. One is that I also believe that this bill is an improvement over the present system, if for no other reason than it breaks the present trends of the existing system. And this is perhaps the most important item that we received from our actuaries, and we did spend $30,000 to have the present legislation reviewed by independent consulting actuaries. And we asked them specifically, what is it that you feel is the strongest feature of this bill? And that's what their answer was to me. I don't want to make the day darker than what it already is, but I also want to bring up the fact that we have two companies that in the past wrote 12% of all the workers' comp premium in the state. And those two companies are Pacific Marine Insurance Company of Alaska and Pacific Marine Insurance Company of Washington. Both of them are in receivership. Both companies together wrote 1/8 of all the workers' comp premium. They're no longer writing workers' comp, and they're unable to do so. At this point, I'm not prepared to say that either company is insolvent, but most definitely they're impaired. Should we approach this a situation where either or both of those companies were to go into liquidation, their workers' comp claims would have to be picked up by the remaining workers' comp carriers in the state.
I hear you. This is one of the
and that would be 2% of the premiums that the remaining companies are writing. I say this in relationship to mandatory rate decreases. I would not want to see a situation where mandatory rate decreases led to the withdrawal of companies and further reduce the capacity of the guarantee fund to pick up claims in insolvency type situations. With that, I have nothing further.
I just have a couple questions. You referred to a study you had done. Is that Milliman and Robertson?
Yes, it is.
I just have a cover letter of January 29th here and a draft report. It's in everybody's packet under, I don't know what tab it's under, let's see, Rates, Mill, and Rob report. But their summary statement on page 3 of their January 29th letter says, in summary, the proposed law amendments may, which is emphasized, have a beneficial impact on some aspects of workers' compensation system. However, we are not yet convinced that the proposed law will result in significant overall cost reductions and are concerned that it may even increase costs. And they have several other aspects in this letter, but that would be obviously dealing with the initial bill that was introduced. I don't know what comment you have on that.
I believe that's a, is that a three-page letter?
Yeah.
That was prior to the Milliman and Robinson actually producing a 23-page report.
Well, I have a draft called discussion draft report here. Do you have the final report?
I'm not absolutely certain whether the draft report is that much different from the final report. I'm sure in our record someplace there is a final report. I'd be more than happy to provide you with a copy.
Okay. One of the factors that they pointed out, I don't know if I want to get into a lot of detail right now, but they're quite concerned about various aspects, the incremental adjustment factors. They give an example for a claimant judge 10% impaired would receive $4,800, where a claimant judge 11% impaired would receive $10,560. That's quite a difference in a 1% rating. Does that show up in the final too, or is that just
no,
a preliminary?
Based on what Milliman and Robertson did, the people who were the driving force behind this bill sat down with their own person as well as with Milliman and Robertson and redesigned that curve in order to, they took the lumps out of it. It was a kind of a step type of thing that if you had from 0 to 5%, you got a certain rating, then from 6 to 11. Well, we were able to provide a curve to them which at every percentage point you could get a specific rating, and that took out some of the unfairness of what you just spoke to at this moment.
Okay. Additionally, last Wednesday night we had some testimony from Bob Anders regarding what he saw some problems in the schedule on permanent partial disability. Are you familiar with those issues he was talking about?
Some of them I am, yes.
Are you going to propose any changes?
Well, I spoke to Dick Catnow, who is somewhat Bob Anders' counterpart on that ad hoc task force, and they asked us if we would provide our consulting actuary so that they could further streamline and make modifications to that schedule. As yet, I have not. That was they were to speak with the actuary on Friday, and as of today, I have not heard what they've come up with. But they were concerned about rearranging the benefits again on the schedule to somehow make them more fair.
Okay, also, I'm not real familiar with workers' comp, and I know some of you have been through 5 or 6 hearings before you got here, so it may sound like you're repeating yourself, but I don't think any of us have heard the story before. Going to what's called the whole man concept here, and in terms of permanent partial, could you just give us a history of your experience with that? I mean, we're doing away with unscheduled issues here, and it seems to me that it's a major change in the system.
Yes, it is, and again, this is sort of hearsay from people who came up with the whole man concept. It's my understanding that with United States Longshoremen and Harbor Workers coverage, they use something similar to the whole man concept, and they come up with a figure, and it's pretty much arbitrarily arrived at as to what the whole man is worth, the whole woman is worth. And that number, that magic number, became $240,000. Then you take each part of the body and figure out what percentage of the overall body, that is, and then you figure out your impairment. So if your arm is worth 10% of your body, and it's 50% impaired, you do the multiplication, and you get a 5% of the total body is impaired, and you take that 5% times 240, or using the adjustment factor, and you come up with a number. The problem with the system is that in some instances, different parts of the body are worth more to different people. Depending upon the occupation that you're in. A loss of a leg to a lawyer probably doesn't mean a whole heck of a lot. It's a horrible injury, but that person can probably continue in their profession with the loss of a leg or even the loss of two legs. On the other hand, if you're a laborer, the loss of a foot is catastrophic. And so there's difficulty, in at least in my thinking and some other people, in trying to make those numbers fair. But the whole band concept really does not take that into account, because the types of occupations that are involved.
Well, under our existing system, we use a loss of burning capacity,
mm-hmm.
which would reflect a lot of that. So this seems to me as a real major change. I agree with you in your analysis that loss of my left arm is a little different than the loss of a pilot's left arm in terms of ability to earn money, but under this bill here, we're saying there is no difference. Regardless of who you are, what your occupation is, doesn't make any difference here. A leg's a leg's a leg.
And that's correct. There is a major change in this.
Or do any other states do it that way?
I was asked that question, and we called around because we wanted to find out what other states were using as the number for the same man. And there are a couple of other states, but they're hybrid systems that really have no... It's impossible to compare with a couple of other states, one of them being Nevada, what they're doing in relationship to us because of the uniqueness of their laws. And I can't think of any state that has the type of system exactly that we have, and those that are closest to it are so different that we really can't compare them to. At least that's my understanding.
Representative Ulmer?
My question related back to the study that the chairman asked about. In your summary comments, you indicated that the study concluded, you indicated that the study concluded that the most important thing this bill does is, and I think you said previous to that, breaking the cycle of cost, but I wonder if you could just explain clearly what you said and what it said.
That's not in the report. When we had both the actuary from the NCCI, which is the rating organization for the workers' comp people, and our own independent actuary, Mike McMurray of Milman Robertson, and we had them in the room together, and the question was directed, what is the most significant, important feature of this bill, the most beneficial feature? Well, from the actuarial point of view, is that it breaks the present trend in the law as we know it today, our present law. That's not to say that the proposed legislation may be a runaway system. I doubt that it's going to be. But the present system, the costs have been running out of control. I mean, the rate increases have been horrendous. And I think everybody knows it, and we wouldn't be in this room today if they weren't that bad. So according to the actuary, what they feel is that trend will be broken. We'll have a new law in place, which will, in their opinion, be better able to contain costs. For example, this whole man concept, we'll know exactly where we're going to be at when it comes to paying out on permanent partial disabilities.
Just a question on the vicarious beneficiaries. Would you support an amendment to that now the plaintiff's lawyers have to submit all of their costs and fees to the board for approval, and it's a misdemeanor if they take any other amount in excess of that or outside of that what's approved? Would you submit support an amendment to require all the defense lawyers to submit all their costs to the board for approval?
I know the insurance carriers would feel that there's an added administrative burden, which there would be, but I would certainly like to know, because this issue comes up not just in workers' comp, but in the area of tort reform, as to how much the lawyers are getting. And it's my understanding the defense lawyers usually get more than the plaintiff's lawyers. And yet the plaintiff's lawyers get are the ones that are cheap. Defense lawyers would come to us and say, we'll settle this case once we get a certain number of dollars out of it. And I think just about any lawyer who's fair-minded will tell you that that's happening. Now, that my preliminary comments were that there has to be some kind of discipline within the professions, and that's one of the areas that I think really needs to be addressed. And if we can find out who is actually getting paid, I'm told that the defense costs are put into adjustment expenses. So if you have an adjuster working on the case, and then later it goes to the attorney's defense, then all of those costs are put together. And so there'd be some difficulty, I'm sure, initially in designing a system to be able to separate them out. And again, this is one of the problems with the entire system, is trying to get pure costs. What are the pure medical costs? What are the pure legal defense costs? I guess about the only pure costs that come out of the system are from the workers' comp board when it comes to the claimants' attorneys. I think they're able to have the ability to determine how much they're getting.
Simple amendment. Just take the statute that makes it a misdemeanor for the plaintiff's lawyer to receive any cost, gratuity, or gift on the case except what is awarded by the board, and just add in the defense attorneys, adjusters, and the whole bit right into the same statute.
Well, I don't know whether you want to make it a misdemeanor. I mean, I can't.
It is a misdemeanor now.
For the plaintiff's lawyers, but it's not the same analogous situation for the defense. I mean, where else would they get money from other than from the employer's insurance carrier?
It's money received in excess of what the board awarded.
Well,
it would be a misdemeanor to give any more, same as it is with the plaintiff's lawyers. Just to make the rules the same,
I mean, in other words, you'd have the board making an award of defense costs as well?
Yes.
I'd have to give some thought to that.
That's
the first time I even thought about the board.
Draft up an amendment, and then people can think about it. We've got three other people to testify. Representative Greenberg?
Yeah, that concept, I think, is an important concept. I say that concept is an important concept because right now, and this really is an aspect of it's workers' comp, but it's an aspect of the same issue. Right now, only plaintiffs' attorneys have been limited with respect to Rule 82 under the tort reform bill we passed a couple of years ago. And it seems to me that there are severe constitutional problems in doing that sort of a thing. And if we only have one side that's limited in its fees under the current workers' comp schedule, the plaintiffs, in effect, are denied equal access to the courts because in this to the board, because in this technical area, you really need to have competent legal counsel. And if one side has its hands tied, I think there's some severe constitutional problems in that, don't you?
Well, I'd certainly say it doesn't make it fair, and I guess the essence of due process is fairness, mm-hmm. is that there should be a level playing field.
And, other courts have dealt with, in the tort reform area, the cap on economic damages as basically denying people, unconstitutional as denying people access to the courts. And I realize that isn't the situation here because it's a different situation. But if you have one side that's limited in the amount of costs it can expend in developing its case, that really does deny them equal access.
It would also be interesting to see, too, with defense costs in particular. I know in a lot of states, 10% for claimants' attorneys is pretty standard. But I'd just be curious to know that whether the defense in Alaska are making more money than the defense in other states.
The theory is we ought to have a system that should work without any lawyers in it.
Well, that was one of the comments that I made at another hearing, is that here's a system that's no fault and designed not to have lawyers in it, and the lawyers are making millions of dollars. I mean, something's wrong.
You got that right.
I have a question.
Okay, and then I'd like to make sure I get the other testimony in here, too.
Expect that he will be able to answer. Excuse me. I do not expect that the gentleman before us, Mr. Lower will be able to answer this. Looking at this diagram, I hope somebody will during the course of the hearing. If a person, say, gets this much of the foot cut off, who decides what that much of the foot is worth?
My understanding is there's a book that the doctors use, and they have all of these things in the book, and they can look in the book, and they can come up with a number. Now, I've never seen the book. I understand there may even be two books, but supposedly in that book, all types of injuries of every sort whatsoever, a person will be able to make a determination.
I note on the whole benefit structure, we're going to go over that on tomorrow, so we can get into those questions tomorrow.
I hope somebody brings the book. I sure would like to.
I assume there, from what I've heard, there's several books. So we will. Jackie McClintock tells me she has one book. She'll bring it with us tomorrow. Okay. Thank you very much, Paul.
Thank you.
Stan Sparks, are you with us?
Yes, sir. I'm here. Can you hear me?
Appreciate if you'd identify yourself, who you work for, and offer your comments, please.
Yes, sir. My name is Stan Sparks. I'm with the National Council on Compensation Insurance, and I'm headquartered in Portland, Oregon. We are the licensed rating organization for the state of Alaska, and we administer the assigned risk pool for the national pool, and that takes in assigned risk pool of assignments. I was told that you would like to pose some questions to me with regard to the surcharge that's currently in effect in Alaska, and I'll be glad to respond to questions.
Yeah, Stan, maybe just face the committee is a committee right now that isn't real familiar with the whole workers' comp situation, but if you could describe how the assigned risk pool works, who gets into it, why they're in it, and how do you ever get out of it?
Okay, well, basically, there is a voluntary market in Alaska, and most employers who are required to have workers' compensation insurance coverage are insured through the voluntary mechanism. In some instances, there are risks with very bad high accident rates and the like, and the carriers find them so unattractive that those people are placed into the assigned risk pool. There are starting businesses with no history, oftentimes find themselves in the pool, and unfortunately there are small risks that irregardless of their loss history, are unable to find voluntary coverage, they also fall into the pool. That's essentially how it works. It's like a an auto insurance pool for the worse than average risks. These are largely based on underwriting judgments, and the turn down is made on the basis of an individual company's underwriting expertise and their judgments. Application is then made for those who are unable to get voluntary market coverage. The applications are made through this office, and we place the risks on a blind rotational basis to the five servicing carriers in Alaska. Those risks that go into the assigned risk pool are faced with a 20% surcharge above and beyond the normal rate for the particular risk, depending on the various job classification. Now, the question arises, is that fair to particularly the small risk or to a beginning business? That's a valid question, and it's one that the system has grappled with for some years. It's not fair in many cases, but it's very difficult to ferret out those that genuinely belong there because they have such bad loss histories that otherwise they could not get insurance, versus those that are just too small or just starting up without any history. It's it's analogous, I suppose, to, you know, loans from a bank. If you've got no credit history, or you've got very bad credit history, it's very hard to get a loan. Law mandates that every employer, there are certain exceptions, but they're very limited, but just about everybody who's an employer must provide workers' comp coverage. So there has to be some mechanism to provide that coverage, even to the very least desirable risk. So that, in essence, is what the pool is and how it operates. Now, how do you get out of the pool? Carriers, and the market in Alaska has been very competitive. Carriers are constantly trying to find good risks. So there is shopping that's done from the assigned risk pool, and it's not at all uncommon for employers who find themselves in the pool who have demonstrated a good loss history to find coverage outside the pool, that is on a voluntary basis and without any penalty.
I guess I understand that a little bit. I kind of disagree with the theoretical aspects of how it works. It seems to me that every business in the state of Alaska, if it's an Alaska business, gets, as it starts up, gets shoved in the assigned risk pool under the small risk theory or small premium theory. And could you tell us, I mean, what is the smallest premium you have to have, or what break off on premium before you don't automatically get put into the assigned risk pool when you start a business in the state?
Well, I think it's accurate to say that anybody goes automatically into the pool. We're speaking now of startup businesses or businesses which are located outside the state and are operating branch operations in Alaska. It's not an automatic thing. It's on the basis of having applied, being viewed by one or more companies who have their underwriting standards and judgments to make, and a turndown. A business person goes first to one of the major writers, and it's only when they're turned down that they turn to the pool.
Yeah. Do you have a number, a premium number that you could give us as a, I mean, $0 to $1 million, what break line is it?
Well, I can tell you the average size of the risks in the pool in Alaska for 1987, the average size risk was $3,896 in annual premium. Now, that's an average, and there are some that are very large risks, and there are some that are quite a bit smaller than that. But on average, the average size risk in the Alaska pool in 1987 was just under $4,000.
Okay. I guess, you know, I can give you a personal example where we started a company up, and we did our payroll through a joint operating company that was doing payroll for several different businesses. And then after 2 or 3 years, we split out and decided to do our own payroll, and we're arbitrarily put in the assigned. We were in the assigned risk pool because we were a new company to start with, and then when we split our payroll out, we got shoved in it again on the theory that we were a new company and nothing had changed. And I guess that you get a little frustrated when an arbitrary rule. We were at a company of, I don't know, 5 or 6 years of history before we got out of this this vacuum place. But I don't know. So I don't quite agree with you that it's totally a competitive aspect. And I guess the other question I have, I understand that the bad risks is the necessary to have a 20 or 30% premium on top of your normal rating. But what happens to a company that's been in business for 3 or 4 years and has a good rating history and then comes out of the assigned risk pool? Is there any rebate of the high premiums they've paid into that pooling aspect?
No, sir, there is not.
Should there be?
I'm not sure how you would adjust that. Would you add a penalty on the other side if their loss history was worse than average?
Well, if it was worse than average, I assume they couldn't get out of it.
mean, one of the difficulties here is that employers are failing to use their agents or doing enough individual shopping around. Typically, I think the uninitiated employer goes to a carrier that has other kinds of liability insurance on his operations, and if they're turned down for comp from that carrier, they give up and go into the pool. My advice to, and I tell many employers to call me, is simply to shop around. Because you get one turn down doesn't mean that another competing company will also take that same attitude, especially if there is a good loss history. That's the thing that that influences underwriters more than anything else, is what kind of loss experience given risk of debt. Every company, of course, every insurer wants to get the best possible risk, that risk which is the least likely to have accidents, and that one which has the least amount of accidents in its past. But those are the kinds of underwriting judgments that are involved. I should point out also that the national pool, of which Alaska is a part, is a terribly unprofitable enterprise. The national pool has lost millions and millions of dollars, and built into the existing voluntary market rate is a subsidy, if you will, for the assigned risk pool. And I'm told that of every dollar paid on a voluntary basis by good risk, 12 cents of that already is subsidizing, in part, the assigned risk pool. Now, if you do away with the surcharge, you're going to increase that cross-subsidization. And I know that in other states, when that has become known, the large companies with good loss histories who take loss engineering seriously get very upset at the prospect of having to subsidize those companies which have bad loss histories, which maintain unsafe working conditions, and those who have no credit history, if you will. They object to that kind of cross-subsidization. So these are the kinds of problems we're faced with. I should also point out that on a national level, this question is being given serious attention, namely the flight of the small business operation, which has difficulty in getting coverage and finds itself placed in assigned risk pool. There is currently a national task force called the Depopulation Task Force of the national pool, and they are to make a report at the end of June and come up with recommendations for means of limiting the placing of particularly new businesses which have no history whatsoever, to try to soften, to make it easier for them to get into a voluntary market situation, or to penalize them somehow less for ending up in the assigned risk pool. I can't speak for that task force, but I know that they have been looking, among other things, at some sort of a bifurcated system whereby a small untested risk would be charged a surcharge, but not the full surcharge that an operation which clearly is there for all the right reasons, namely a very bad loss history, some sort of a stepped approach to it. And as time goes on and a accident-free history is built up, they could have less and less of penalty and eventually end up in the voluntary market. That's the sort of thing that this task force is grappling with. So it's not a problem unique to Alaska.
Well, I guess my point is that my understanding is you don't do any individual, or people don't get individual ratings if they have small premiums under, say, $3,000, and they don't get rated, and small companies tend to just get put in the assigned risk pool because nobody else wants them. So, you know, the answer of does this legislation that we have in front of us help small employers, am I ever going to get out of the assigned risk pool? I was talking with this, and we're talking about most of your Alaskan companies, I think 60 or 70% have 10 or fewer employees. There really is no hope for them in this issue. They are going to be in the assigned risk pool, and they are going to pay a 20% premium regardless of their history or their rating history.
Well, I'd like to think that's not the case, but there may be some that that are doomed to the assigned risk pool forever. You're quite correct. I think what we need to do is to focus on ways that we can minimize that. I think there are going to be certain occupations which are so inherently hazardous that they become very unattractive for anybody to provide coverage for. There's always going to be the reluctance to provide coverage for those kinds of operations, be they small or large. And I'm not sure how you design a system to take that into account.
Well, the one example I have is the Wrangell Sentinel, a paper in Wrangell. It has two part-time employees that the most they do is type on a computer, and they pick up a pair of scissors every other day. It's not exactly your high-risk category, but is doomed to the assigned risk pool forever, and to rates that a lot of times don't make any sense.
Well, again, I would say that those people ought to be pressing their agent, their insurance agent, harder, and they should be pounding on doors of other carriers, because if they're running a safe and non-hazardous kind of operation, they should be viewed as potentially good clients. I think employers give up too easily, I guess is what I'm saying. One turn down and they feel that they're doomed forever to be in the assigned risk pool. That doesn't necessarily have to be the case at all.
Okay, any other questions, Stan? If not, we're going to go after this issue for about a week, Stan. We may give you a call if there's any other issues that come up in this area. Appreciate your help.
I will be in Anchorage on Thursday and Friday, and I can be reached there through my office, so I'd be pleased to talk to you and to respond to any questions that you may have.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Donna Lewis, are you there? Okay, yeah, is Donna on?
She was before.
Donna Lewis and Ken.
Does anyone in Ketchikan copy us? I'll arrange that for you.
Gary, are you here? I'll offer some comments.
In 1980, when we formed, the NCPI rate was $50 per 100 for logging. And we were able to maintain a 17th rate.
Don, are you there?
I am.
Okay, you just kind of broke into our system up here, so maybe I could just give a little introduction and get you to start over again. I asked the Alaska Timber Trust to present some testimony of how they operate and in the system and in Southeast Alaska, and why they have gone out and created their own insurance company, so to speak, and a little bit about the rates of, that they pay for workers' comp compared to the rest of the rates in the state. So, Donna, could you give us a kind of a brief history and where you've been with the company and where you're at now?
Yes. Alaska Timber Insurance Exchange was actually formed in 1980, but it was a takeoff of a program we had with the ALPAC program with Alaska loggers in prior years. And their rates became higher and higher, and the loggers decided to put $1.2 million together to form their own company. Now, in 1980, when this was accomplished, NCCI rate for logging was $50, and we managed to do it at a rate of $17. Now, since that time, as you tell, this year, the rate for NCCI is $46.91, and our rate is $35.67. We still managed to stay below the NCCI rate. The cost of claims processing, medical costs, and the benefits have increased our operating costs dramatically. We do not have paid directors. Most of our, all of our governing people are volunteers. We do employ consulting, underwriting, actuarial, we do Zelda and Roberts also, and of course accounting firm. The increase in ours is noted primarily in the medical, legal, and the benefit changes throughout the years. There is an overutilization of medical treatment, we feel definitely here. It needs to be curbed a little bit, certainly not for the injured employee, but those employees out there that are constantly doctor hopping until they get someone to write the type of report that they want. I think our biggest problem is in the benefit of all of our claimants drawing compensation. We constantly are monitoring this. 68-73% of them are now living in the lower 48, and the benefits are high enough there in areas that they're living in, they have absolutely no wish to return to Alaska and go back into logging. Now, I'm certainly not talking about our truly injured people, which we have a lot of, but the people who do have reasons that we feel should be returning to the workforce. The other thing we feel is not working at all is the rehabilitation program under the way it's set up now. This isn't just our feeling. We have claimants constantly complaining about it, becoming frustrated with it, stop working with the rehab people. This nearly skyrockets the price because of their frustration in dealing with these people. Some changes need to be addressed in that. We have no, at least I have no objection to insurance companies reporting annually in a lot more detail to the insurance commissioner on their expenditures. I heard this discussed in December when I did go to one of these hearings. So I went back to our office, all as we are, compared to the other insurance companies. It was no great problem to change our accounting system. The January 1st, we now can tell you every dime is spent in the claims department and exactly in which area it's spent. I don't see why any other insurance company can't do exactly the same. We know defense attorneys, we know our own. Our first 3 months is not really a good thing to give you statistics on, because that includes prior years. But by the time the end of the year comes, we should have a real good average for our insurance commissioner's office. We've done a lot of work in our safety program, and I think that benefits us, bringing down our claims and our workers' comp. Alaska Timber has met the challenge of high workers' comp rate increases and claim costs by emphasizing on the safety. We have an effective safety program for our insured members. This program is constantly upgraded and improved, and it's responsive to the accidents and incidents that are occurring in the field. While ATI safety program is meeting the needs of today's forest product industry, our program has long range objectives. Safety, and in the fall of 87, ATI, at the considerable expense, hired a new safety director. We hired an expert in the field of logging safety who has the ability and experience to carry out ATI safety program. The improvement in ATI safety programs are based on his experience of what has been successful in the forest product industry in other states. We have the Alaska Forest Product Safety Conference, which is held in March of each year. This year it was attended by over 130 people from all over Alaska. ATIE uses the conference as a tool to foster and improve safety. This year's conference theme was improvement will be great in 88. We have on-the-job safety inspections. They're the bread and butter of ATIE safety program. Our safety director conducts thorough inspections of the work sites of our insured members. Inspections are followed up by reports to the insured, who has 30 days to correct their safety TIE has the resources to counsel the employer on how to improve his safety program or how to correct a specific problem. We conduct safety programs upon request by insureds, but we also require all members of the exchange to send us copies of their safety meeting minutes. We do give our insureds a break on good safety programs. They have safety bonuses that they give to their insureds. We allow them to deduct that part of the payroll from paying a premium on it. This cannot be tied to production. That's not what we mean. Our reduction in premium is for the employer to make more money. We mean it for safety for the employee. Our new safety director has written booklets on logging and sawmill safe practice guidelines. We just have our distributing updated copies on these. They spell out the do's and the don'ts for employees in both the logging and sawmill industry. I have a comment on including a reduction on rates with this bill, which I have great difficulty with agreeing with that, because there's just too many reasons on rate promulgation that you need to factor in there. I would prefer not to see this attached to the amendment, but to request the insurance company to provide a more detailed expense accounting of their claims processing and leave this up to the NCCI and Insurance Commissioner's Office. I think they're better qualified to determine what rate promulgation should be. I do have my safety director here and my claims manager if anyone would like to direct this question.
Thank you, Donna. I just want to note on the record here, one of the reasons I asked for the Alaska Timber Trust to testify is that this is the second time that they've put together a company, a reciprocal insurance company, when their rates got too high. They did it and dropped their rates from, I think the testimony was $50 a thousand in the outside world to $17. They later, I think INA took over after that and went back up, and the loggers went out and created another company and have done it again, and now their rates are substantially lower than the marketplace, and yet they're still dealing in the same world. It's the same benefit world, it's the same doctors, it's the same rating world, it's the same statutory world, and yet they have rates that are substantially lower than the other insurance carriers are offering, and that just leads me and my inherent skepticism to believe that we have an insurance problem here in addition to a benefit problem. I think the history of the Alaska Timber Trust dealing in one of the most dangerous professions in the state has proven that out. And the other thing I'd like to comment is what I started my testimony with Don Koch, is that they have linked safety to workers' comp insurance. And we do not have a link between our Division of Insurance and our Department of Labor in terms of are we somehow tracking accidents in the workplace with our insurance rates. This is a direct link. They have, at this hearing here, have their safety director sitting next to their person running their insurance program for workers' comp. They're one and the same. I just wanted the committee and the people to have the benefit of that testimony. So I really don't have a question, Donna. I just appreciate you coming over and offering that history. If you or your director of safety have any comments to offer us on where we should be going, I'd appreciate having them.
Thank you. We will send a written report to the committee.
Okay, and thank you very much for breaking out your expenses. I think that's a good point, and we're going to deal with the Division of Insurance here to see if we can't get something put together where all companies can report not only what they pay in their plaintiff's costs, but also the defense costs of these issues, so we'll have a better idea where that's coming from. If there aren't any further questions, thank you very much, and we'll go to Gary Prudhomme here.
My name is Gary Purdom. I'm the Vice President and Division Manager of Industrial Engineering of Alaska. I'm also the current acting chair of the Alaska Classification Rating Committee. I'm wearing two hats in that light. Briefly touching on Industrial Engineering of Alaska. We employ about 80 people in Anchorage, offering full services for property liability workers' compensation insurance. And according to the latest figures for 1987, we write approximately 15% of the workers' compensation business in the state of Alaska. I appreciate the opportunity coming in and talking at hearing, and also to read the comment on what Donna went over. I think clearly one of the big issues in workers' compensation is the distinction between a commitment to safety that one employer has versus another, or in a group. And in the case of the Timber Exchange, I think the results speak to themselves in the sense that a very active, meaningful safety program has made a big difference. And no one's going to save more money in the system than to simply eliminating the loss, which getting into it, you know, once a loss occurs, which will happen, we have to deal with that, and I think we have to deal with that more effectively than what we have been. But the bottom line is those people who have committed to safety, and we see it in insurance that we write individually and obviously in that group. Nevertheless, the current system, by virtually every measurement, is too expensive. The cost has increased beyond what is a reasonable economic burden. In fact, it has become an economic burden on everybody. I believe the Management Labor Ad Hoc Committee is on track in taking the approach they have in the sense that it's not the insurance companies or some of these other third-party players in the work comp arena, but the people directly involved in it. And I applaud their efforts, I think, that the months and months they put into this, and to the degree that the core of what they're trying to do is continued to this point, is a testament to the efforts they put into it. Really, they've broken the system down into two parts, and there's the actual benefits themselves. And the second part is the cost of delivering those benefits. Now, my understanding, and as I look at the bill, what I see is there's not an attempt, and they do not represent that there's an attempt to actually reduce benefits. There is a reallocation of those benefit dollars, but the thrust of this bill is part one of what they hope to be another round of adjustments to our comp system. And included in that part one is looking at the cost of delivering benefits, which has gotten some attention already this afternoon. Reducing the cost, the expense of getting the benefits to the employee, and streamlining those benefits to make it more efficient are really what's at issue. The difficulty from the insurance company standpoint is trying to evaluate what we've coined the term, or somebody's coined the term, soft dollar issues. In other words, the benefits are usually measured in hard dollar costs. And the soft dollar merits of this bill are what has taken a lot of time and energy of the insurance companies and the CNR committee. Last week, after looking at this for a while, looking mainly following the Senate version of the bill, the Alaska CNR committee moved to basically give a letter of intent to the Division of Insurance that in its current state, the Senate version of the bill would be viewed as a law adjustment to the current system that would result in a 5.7% reduction in premiums to employers in the state when the bill becomes effective. Now, having looked at the soft dollars and struggled with them, a big part of the 5.7% really represents a good faith effort, if you will, on the part of the industry to try and look at the efforts that are being put forth to cut down the cost of what has become an expensive system. And I think that it's fair to say that there's a pretty high degree of optimism that the players that are involved in the system, from the work comp board, the Supreme Court, the attorneys, the doctors, and the insurance companies, adopt this bill in the spirit that is intended. And I think that spirit is that one, to streamline the system. Right now, if there's one area that's causing a lot of expense, it's the fact that we're constantly struggling with what's the right benefit for the right person. And I think that's where the bill is directed. I think it's appropriate. And to the degree that we can remove some of the ambiguity that leads to litigation, some of the uncertainty that leads to litigation, other issues that are related to the degree of medical care and such that even if it's not a state, they see the same thing we see, that it tends to be overused or inappropriately used, and it's needless dollars that should be going to the injured workers. or be a result in premium savings to employers. Those soft dollar areas, or dollar areas, I think, are inappropriate to look at. And the CNR committee has made an evaluation that can result in a 5.7% decrease based on the current state of the Senate bill. You've heard commentary earlier, and I guess mostly to be on the record, jump on the bandwagon, and I heard Paul say it, and Don Koch and Donna. We do not favor, in fact, we're strongly opposed to any language that legislatively is designed to establish rate levels through rate reductions or other mandated rebates or rollbacks. That kind of activity is viewed by industry as a red flag that somebody's going to dictate how much you deliver in area benefits and how much you can take in to cover those costs. I do not think that it's advantageous to the state, for anybody in the state, to minimize the ability to provide coverage through carriers that many of them operate in Alaska on a more or less incidental basis. But the incidental writings in the state, carriers who have 1-3% of the premium, they make up a large portion of the state. And I think sending the wrong message to those carriers is a mistake in the sense that competition will be reduced and employers will see the pricing pressures because of that. I know you're short on time. What I'd like to do is field any questions that you may have on the insurance company's perspective of the bill.
Yeah, I just want to clarify one thing in this letter that came actually from National Council on Compensation Insurance on a 5.7% reduction. Does that still stand even with the knowledge that we have now that the schedules on permanent partial disability in the bill do not reflect what some people feel the agreement was? If we go in and make some adjustments to those schedules, is that going to affect that decision?
It may very well affect it. The 5.7 is clearly a reflection of what's now in the bill. If the benefit schedule is adjusted, it'll be reevaluated, and obviously it depends on what those changes are. I might add that the benefit section that you're describing is part of that hard dollar label, and even though you still have to make some estimates, I guess the actuaries do, it's a much, much more quantifiable, and the impact of changes in that area are easier to address.
Well, I think there will be some changes because the testimony last Wednesday was if there are not some changes, the labor aspect of labor management task force doesn't want the bill.
Okay. Actually, I've not talked to the task force.
That seemed to be pretty major, a major statement.
Yeah, I actually heard that this morning. I had not talked to the task force since the end of last week, or since the middle of last week when that took place.
Okay. Go ahead, Representative Grunberg.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Pruitt. Mr. Purdom, if the choice were to have that clause in there on the rate rollback or to have no bill, which would you prefer, if that were a condition of the bill?
I basically think it would be a mistake to have the clause in there, and if in fact that were the choice, no bill would probably be a better alternative.
Thank you.
I guess just a follow-up on the commitment to safety issue and what the Timber Trust has been able to do in the logging aspects of having a commitment to safety of reducing their rates from, well, at one time they were 50 to 60 to 80% lower than the industry, and now they're about 25% lower. Is there any interpretation that you could take and say if workers went out and increased their safety records across the board that they could drop their premiums by 25%? They did it in the timber industry. Why couldn't we do it in other industries?
I think that there's a message there. Whether or not in the timber industry the numbers are actually going to carry over, there's no question that where people have successful safety programs, they have cut their cost. I can give you one quick example. And granted, unfortunately, these items make sense usually for the larger insured who has time, effort, and resources to vote. And larger insured typically have some losses, so they're controlling something that has a track record of measurement of what took place and what the improvement is. But an example is a contractor in Homer that we insure, Tony Neal, who through his premium program reduces comp rates by a third. And there's no question in my mind that they are totally